Program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today we're going to be talking about media reform with the CEO and president of Common Cause, the national nonpartisan organization that lobbies on behalf of the public interest. Shelley Pingree is the president, and before coming to Common Cause, Shelley Pingree experienced a decade of politics, serving for 8 years in the Maine Senate, where she spent the last 4 years, from 96 to 2000, as the Senate Majority Leader, only the second woman in Maine to hold that office. Pingree, in 2002, ran a hard-fought U.S. Senate race against popular incumbent Republican Senator Susan Collins, received 42% of the vote. Since then, she's come to Washington, D.C., or gone to Washington, D.C., I guess, and she's now working at Common Cause as its president and chief executive officer. In her domain, or during the Pingree administration at Common Cause, media has become a central issue, a central area of concern for the organization, turning really a new chapter in the history of the organization. And that's what we want to talk to Shelley Pingree about today. Shelley, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
It is really an honor to have you here. And I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with Common Cause and the rich history of the organization. People interested right now, just near a computer or later on, can go to www.commoncause.org, which is the homepage, and learn all about the organization. But for maybe some of our listeners unfamiliar with the history of Common Cause, maybe you could give us a little background.
I'd be glad to, and it's just a pleasure for me to be working with this organization that's been around for over 30 years. It was actually started in 1971 by a man named John Gardner, who many people were familiar with at the time. He was the only Republican in the Johnson administration. Actually, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare had done a lot of interesting things before he came into politics. And he left the administration over a dispute about his feelings around the Vietnam War and decided we should start a citizen's lobby. His motto was, everybody's organized but the people. And he started asking people to join an organization for a small fee every year to really participate and let their voices be heard. And really, within no time, they had about 200,000 members, which, when you think of the days before the Internet, that was a lot of people in 5 or 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And Common Cause has gone on over the years to be a really important player in Washington and states around the country. Our issues range really from everything that we think is a fundamental of democracy, which can include campaign finance reform, the Freedom of Information Act, making sure that people had access to information, open meetings, ethics laws, the 18-year-old vote. I mean, we've really taken on a lot of different issues, and as you know, today we're really focusing on many of the same things, campaign finance reform and ethics, but really looking at as well the role that the media plays in our democracy.
Now, Common Cause is a nonpartisan group. It sounds like the sort of issues you've named for the most part are not ideologically laden, or at least partisan laden, in terms of Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative.
Well, we think of them as really, the fundamentals of what makes a democracy work. You know, citizens need to trust their democracy, know they can get good information, know that people who get elected to office aren't beholden to money or special interests when they get there, know that their vote is going to count on election day, and know that they can get good information. So we really believe that our issues are the issues that are critical to democracy, and over the years we've worked with Republicans and Democrats and people of a whole variety of parties and non-parties, really, because we think these issues are so critical.
Now, you come to the presidency of Common Cause as a Democrat, as mm-hmm. someone who ran for the Senate and has had a long career as a liberal Democrat, if I may say so.
proud to say it as well.
That's right, and I'm happy to report that as well. Does that compromise your ability to be taken seriously as a nonpartisan organization when they look at you and say, well, here's someone who clearly has strong political viewpoints that are partisan? Can you operate an organization which is trying to bring people together across political boundaries?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one of the great things about having served so many years in political life, in fact, more of my political life was spent in nonpartisan offices like school board and planning board and, you know, some of the local offices I served in. But even while Majority Leader of the Senate, which was the Democratic leader of the Maine Senate, I always found ways to work across the aisle. And I frankly think sometimes when you've been in politics, you understand even more than those people who sit on the outside what it is to build bridges, how to work on issues based on the issues and the values that we share, not strictly on partisan opportunities and you know, the next election cycle necessarily. So I actually have a pretty good understanding of how to focus on issues and respect the tradition of Common Cause, that, you know, we share an ideological concern with many Republicans and Democrats. And interestingly, depending on the state we're working on, the concerns that we have, sometimes our greatest allies are Republicans, sometimes they're Democrats. It really often depends on which party is in power and which party chooses to abuse that power.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that within 6 months, back in 1971, Common Cause generated 200,000 members. And I think how many members does the organization have today?
About 250,000 members and supporters. You know, it's a different world now that you can use the internet to also work with people. So I have to say, we have it easy compared to John Gardner, who really found so many supporters, frankly, by taking out full-page ads in the newspaper and word of mouth.
And you mentioned that you do local work. It's not just a national Washington, D.C.-based lobby, but you work in local chapters around the country?
We do. We have some local chapters, and we have state organizations with offices and staff in 38 states around the country. So we have an office in Illinois. We have offices really in many states, generally focusing on more state-based issues, the ethics, the campaign finance reform issues that operate in legislatures. Sometimes there are questions of fair taxation, open meetings, and increasingly issues like media and voting and election year concerns.
Voting and election year concerns, what, is that like the voting machine stuff?
Absolutely. We have been, prior to even some of the most recent concern about voting machines, we have been involved in the issue of just the vote, the 18-year-old vote, how voting and the process works. But particularly after the 2000 elections, we got involved in supporting the Help America Vote Act, lobbying for its passage, its funding, the implementation. As you may know, that Elections Assistance Commission was actually only recently appointed, but we testified in front of them a few weeks ago, suggesting that there needed to be a paper trail on all machines and that we needed to uphold the standards that we're very concerned, frankly, won't be upheld in this year's election cycle. So we're monitoring that. We're lobbying in the states that have efforts going on, and we're putting together a program with a lot of other organizations to make sure that everyone is volunteering on Election Day to monitor their polling place and to make sure that every vote, frankly, gets counted.
You know, and I'll tell you, I talk to a lot of people who are friends of mine, and there's one issue when it comes to these voting machines and these elections are coming up, and there's almost a defeatism. The people say, look, we're screwed. There's really not, we can't stop this. If people want to do hanky-panky, we're just nail on this one. I don't know if it's justified, but there is a real sort of sense that that this is something outside the control of politics as usual, our ability to organize to sort of get a fair election. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think I share a lot of people's concern that this is an issue we ought to take very seriously. You know, for a long time, we've been proud in the United States to send election observers to countries all around the world, and I feel like this is one of the first times where we really need to focus on monitoring our own elections in this country. So what I would hate to see happen is too many voters say, oh, my vote's never going to count, I'm just discouraged, why bother? I think it's a really important year for people to link up with those organizations that are doing election protection, election monitoring, going to their polling places, making sure that voting machines are able to verify the vote, making sure that they're there on election day. There's a whole lot of ways people can participate and make sure not only their vote counts, but that everybody in their community has a vote that counts. And I really do think people are right to be concerned. I think there are going to be a lot more problems, and if it is another close election, it will make a big difference if there are machines in different parts of the country or county clerks and election officials who turn people away for the wrong reasons. This will be a very serious election.
We're talking to Shelley Pingree today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Shelley Pingree is the president and chief executive officer of Common Cause, a nonpartisan national organization that lobbies in behalf of the public's interests in a broad range of issues, both the national and local level. You can learn all about Common Cause at www.commoncause.org. I noticed on the homepage, Shelley, I was just browsing through it before the show to sort of bone up on my Common Cause history.
Good for you.
Yeah, so
doing your homework.
Being a good talk show host. And I noticed at the bottom, in rather large type, a strong statement that said, we want you to know that Common Cause was not founded by Ralph Ritenator, but in fact was founded by John Gardner. I suspect you wouldn't have had that up 5 years ago.
Well.
In fact, you probably would have been delighted to have been associated with Ralph Nader. What's the basis for that?
Well, you know, we would still say that we're very respectful of all the great things that Ralph Nader has done in his career as a consumer activist and as a person who's willing to get out there and really speak strongly about the issues that he cares about. There's just an interesting phenomena that goes on a lot of Washington-based organizations where people tend to think that they were all started by Ralph Nader. So, interestingly, we get a tremendous number of phone calls and emails from people who say, we can't belong to Common Cause anymore. We're so mad at Ralph Nader. And so while we respect people's ability to feel however they do about candidates running for president, we just want them to know that we actually have never had any formal association. And his organization that he started in D.C., although he's been involved in many, was Public Citizen, who also has gone far beyond their original mission. But it's interesting. We put it up there because we were getting so many calls and letters, and just wanted to be perfectly clear.
Yes, well, it is perfectly clear. There will be no mistake if you go to the webpage. That's really clear.
Yeah, I think the day he announced his candidacy, our phone lines were literally flooded with people.
Yeah, in fact, I know that when he announced his candidacy, the phone lines at Public Citizen and Multinational Monitor and the groups he actually did help establish in Washington were also flooded, and I suspect they wish they could have said that he hadn't formed them either. But so be it. Let's talk, before we go into the media stuff, let's talk about an issue I think that really was a defining issue for Common Cause in the 1990s, and maybe even to the 80s, I don't know the history well enough, and into this decade, which is the issue of campaign finance. And this is an issue I think that most people, to the extent they know about it, are concerned about it. But it's an issue that, as I look around the political landscape of the United States today, at the federal elections we're going through in the presidential race, it doesn't seem like the situation is getting any better. With all the work that all the groups like Common Cause have done, it seems like we're still really stuck in a morass of corruption when it comes to campaign finance.
Well, I think two things are going on at the same time. I think we're observing an election where, frankly, as you know, more money will be spent than ever before. Likely $1 billion will be spent to elect a president. And two candidates, the primary candidates for office, have opted out of the presidential public financing system, which was a system advanced by Common Cause and many other reform groups after the Watergate era to attempt to remove the corrupting influence of money in politics. You know, the other side of what's going on, which I think we'll have to get ourselves beyond the election to look back, is the phenomena of the Howard Dean campaign, Move On. Even the Republican campaigns now are attracting a tremendous number of small donors who can contribute over the Internet. So on the one hand, you have more people participating probably than ever before in financing a presidential election. On the other side, you still have a tremendous number of large donors who are contributing to the process. And another issue that we both know well, the high costs of campaigning, primarily because of the influence of the media, both in their lack of coverage of what's going on in campaigns and the high cost of advertising on TV. So this is not a simple problem to resolve. I think you're right that the influence of money and its impact on the purchasing of the White House will be greater than ever. On the other side, I think we're going to have to get beyond the elections in some ways to talk about what the next era of reform will look like. I have the good fortune of coming from Maine and living there while we passed our public financing bill, which is similar to what they have in Arizona and a variety of other municipalities and state elections, which is truly just a wonderful system of running for office.
Would you explain that? Because I think not many of our listeners, unless they've been to Maine or Arizona, would know much about it. And it really doesn't get much press coverage either. So there's no way someone living in Champaign-Urbana would necessarily have any clue about this.
It's true. And when you tell people about it, usually they're very impressed and kind of startled that there are campaigns run completely differently. It's often referred to as a clean election system. And not only do I know it well because I served in the legislature, but I happen to have my daughter serving today as a state legislator, and she ran as a clean candidate. The way it works is you find 100 people. Now, remember, Maine's a small state with small legislative districts, but they find 100 people to sign a petition and give them $5, certifying them as a candidate. And once you've turned in all your signatures and your money, you actually become a candidate who qualifies for a relatively small allocation of money that is enough to run a campaign. It's based on the average of the amount spent in the last election cycle. And for most candidates, it doesn't mean you can buy a lot of time on TV, but you can buy some radio time or you can send out flyers. And most people focus on going door to door. Once you're a qualified candidate, you're allowed to accept no other contributions and raise no other money. And if your opponent doesn't run as a clean candidate and raises more money than you, you're able to be matched up to three times the original allocation. So it does level the playing field. The majority of legislators now run under this system today, both Republicans and Democrats. It can also be used in the gubernatorial race, statewide races. And it's really changed the nature of both how people campaign, because you don't have to just sit in a room and call people up and ask them for money. You don't just have to host high-dollar fundraisers and ask special interests who might have something they want in return for the money, but you can meet with people who never saw politicians before, because you can just campaign throughout your district and attempt to get the vote, and once you're elected to office, frankly, you don't owe anything to anybody except the people who went out and voted and asked you to serve in their behalf. So it's a truly different system. Legislators themselves really like running under it because it takes away this burden of constantly trying to raise money. And the other side of it is people who never imagined they could run for office because they didn't know a lot of wealthy people or they didn't have access to their own funds. Now can choose to run for office, minorities, women, a lot of people who weren't often thinking of doing this before. So it's a really revolutionary way of going about doing things, and something that at Common Cause we've been working hard on to get other states to consider doing the same thing.
Well, yeah, what are the prospects in other states? It seems like such a great idea. It seems like something that everyone wins, but I guess not everyone wins, because otherwise it would be in existence in 48 other states.
You'd think it would, and the funny thing is that most politicians like it once it's implemented, mm-hmm. but convincing them to vote for it in the state legislature can be very hard, because people think, you know, they get used to the system that they had to get them into office and think they'll lose their grasp on power if this goes away, particularly members of leadership, so it's often hard to get it through committee or onto the floor. And on the other side, in states where there's referendum, and that's how it was passed, for instance, Arizona, while the system is successful and going well, there's actually a referendum campaign this year to repeal the law, basically mm-hmm. financed by special interest developers, a lot of big money, who says, wait a minute, I don't have the power anymore. I don't like this system. Get it out of there. So there's going to be a huge battle fought this year in Arizona to keep the system, because now that it's implemented and working, not only are there interests in Arizona who want to get rid of it, but I think interests around the country who want to say, we got to stop this now before it goes too many other places.
We're talking to Shelley Pingree today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Shelley is the president and chief executive officer of Common Cause, the public interest group based in Washington, but with operations all across the country. You can learn about Common Cause at www.commoncause.org. And this is a pre-recorded show. We taped it before going on air, so please do not try to call today. Just sit back and let Shelley and me do all the yakking. Shelley, before we conclude our discussion of campaign finance and elections and issues like this, one other issue that I think is of great importance to explaining some of the problems in our electoral system, and an issue, interestingly enough, was in the cover of Business Week magazine recently, is the topic of gerrymandering. And as you know, I think better than anyone, only a small percentage of our House of Representatives seats are competitive anymore. The vast majority of seats are pretty much carved up in such a way that there's no way the party that is allocated that seat could possibly lose it, barring some sort of catastrophe or sex scandal or something. Michael Moore has the joke he likes to tell, and I'm not sure how accurate this is, but it's an awfully impressive joke, that he says he went back and looked, or he had his assistant go back and look, and there was more turnover in the Politburo under Stalin than there is in the U.S. House of Representatives, pointing to the fact that really this is not a very democratic institution, thanks to gerrymandering. We've always had gerrymandering, haven't we? But it seems a lot worse now.
Well, you're absolutely right. I don't know if Michael Moore's right or not, but he probably got it close. It's true there are very few actual opportunities to change who's elected to office these days, because challengers tend to be so safe. One, because they have access to money, and two, because just what you said, districts are usually designed to protect incumbents.
You know, we should probably define gerrymandering. It's not fair. There might be some listeners out there who aren't really familiar with the concept of the term. Why don't you just explain what that is?
Well, it's really, every 10 years, based on the census, a state is required to redistrict, to design both the congressional and state legislative districts so that they reflect shifts in population. You know, most of us know that the shift in population has gone towards the south in this country, so some northern states have actually lost congressional seats. In some places, the shift, in fact, in the state of Maine, where I come from, the shift has been from the northern part of the state down to the southern part of the state, as we lost some of our industrialization and factories in the northern part of the state. So there are always population shifts. Every 10 years, the census shows you how they are, and the legislature is required to redraw those district lines to reflect that. What usually happens, though, is either the party in control draws those lines to protect their members or to design new seats for members of Congress who they want to serve in office, or both parties, in a sense, somewhat collude to say, I'm going to protect all of the incumbents. And if you look at the districts in some states, there'll be these bizarre octopus-shaped districts, long, skinny things. They don't necessarily reflect what would be a good mixture of how people live or what would be an appropriate size or look of a district.
No, in fact, Shelley, in Illinois, as our listeners can tell you, the districts we have in this state look like they were done by some jigsaw master puzzle after taking 30 hits of mescaline or something. And we've got districts that are crazy in this state.
So it's truly democracy on drugs, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Well, you know, most of us, again, this is like one of those obscure little process issues that you say, well, who in the world cares about that? And in a sense, thank goodness for the legislators in Texas who were so angry when the Republican majority came back in. In fact, Tom DeLay and people in Washington said, let's redesign Texas. Even though they'd already redesigned it once, they went back in a couple years later. And the Democratic legislators in that state, and frankly, it can be either party that skews it, so this is not a one-party problem, but the Democratic legislators were so angry, they took off and went to another state, and as you know, they had to be hunted down and dragged back home to take a vote, but they just said, we're not going to put up with this.
But
the
Texas did go ahead and do the second redistricting, didn't it?
They finally came home, they had to take the vote, and, you know, all was not good. They were fined, they had to pay, you know, all kinds of excessive costs of being out of town. But the point is, and what a lot of organizations like ours and others are looking at, is how can we reform the system in a sense to take a little bit of the politics out? Now, one of the models that's often talked about is up near you in Iowa, mm-hmm. where they have a nonpartisan citizen board that has no connection to the legislature that really draws the districts based on other factors than just how to help a political incumbent. Some states are looking at those ways of going about doing it. There are a variety of reforms being advanced. But before we get to the next census, which is now, just 6 years out, mm-hmm. A lot of people are saying, how can we bring some sense into this process? Because, again, if you think about the fundamentals of democracy, you need to have people you elect to office that you trust, and you need to know that if you don't like what they're doing, you can throw them out. And we see the three cores here, the three core issues in how the districts are drawn, are incumbents just unreasonably protected, how do you make sure you level the playing field on money, and how do you make sure citizens get the information that they need so you even know if your person's doing a good job. But this is truly a critical issue, and I think we're going to be talking even more about it. And as you said, when you see it on the cover of Business Week, it's starting to become kind of mainstream.
Yeah, and Business Week basically in their article says, if you look at the situation facing most Americans with elections, it's hard to justify why people would vote in most cases, because except for a handful of states, your vote for president is irrelevant because it's the Electoral College system. And in most House districts, gerrymandering means your vote is irrelevant. And in the vast majority of Senate seats, the incumbent has such a money advantage that your vote's largely irrelevant. There's really only a small percentage of Americans who are in districts where their vote could actually change an election.
And then then it's not so confusing anymore why so many Americans don't bother to vote.
Because yeah, it's not an irrational response to the cues they're actually getting.
Exactly. If you're having a busy day, why would you take the day off to give a vote to someone where it's not even going to make a difference?
Yeah. We're talking to Shelley Pingree today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Again, this is a pre-recorded show because I know you'd like to call in and talk to Shelley, but just let me do the yakking for you today. And let's turn now, Shelley, to media. And before we went on air, we were discussing this because, you know, media has become an issue for Common Cause only since you've become president in the past 2 years. And it's only really become an issue in the last 2 years. And I think Common Cause has been foundational to sort of making it a big political issue in this country. But how does it relate to the issues of campaign finance? And you sort of alluded to it earlier, but I mean, in your view, it's sort of a natural progression, isn't it?
It is, and I have to say, you know, I have so much respect for all the people who've been talking about this issue for a long time, and you certainly are one, and I appreciate that and have learned a lot from all the other organizations that have been out there saying, you know, we've been making some big mistakes. Now, interestingly, Common Cause was somewhat involved in the 96 Telecom Act, but even more interesting were some of the words of John Gardner back in the 1970s, who at that time said he really feared corporate ownership of the media and the opportunities for a corporate owner to use the media to influence perhaps consumer decisions or other things that we've now seen really have become commonplace in how corporations use the media. What interested me when I first came and kind of looking out at the lay of the land of the problems we had been facing and how we were ever going to fix such giant issues like campaign finance reform, was the convergence between, as I said earlier, sort of the costs of running a campaign, the incredible costs that a candidate pays, and as you mentioned, I ran for the United States Senate, so I know how many millions of dollars you have to put together to get your message out on TV, and how little coverage there actually is of what a candidate is doing. So it's a little bit about what happens in campaign finance reform, and we had been supporting a bill for a long time on free airtime for candidates, so we had seen mm-hmm. the value of requiring some public interest obligation to be put back into the system so that candidates could access a certain amount of time so that you could learn about everybody who runs for office in something other than a 15-second or 30-second soundbite or a negative ad. But I think it even goes beyond that, as you well know, on all the decisions that we're making in a democracy. When media doesn't meet its public interest obligation, when you can't get local news or balanced news or, you know, the kind of coverage on issues that you care about, we all become a lot less informed on what the policies are that are being decided in our country. And it's really gotten to, I think, an epidemic proportion. And what we all learned around the June 2nd decision of the FCC was that people were mad all over the country. And they were mad if they were members of the NRA and they thought it was too left-wing. They were mad if they were left-wing and they thought the media was too right-wing and jaded in its coverage of the war. They were mad because their cable rates had gone up. They were mad, you know, because there was no children's programming. I mean, you know, the list is huge. And it really did open up this well where the public said, so who's going to do something about it?
And this is really where Common Cause entered the fray. And we've discussed this issue on Media Matters in the past with a number of guests. But media ownership, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission's review of the handful of remaining rules regulating the ownership that companies can have, companies that receive the government monopoly licenses for radio and TV channels, really became a firestorm issue in the United States in 2003. And Common Cause, this was the issue that really brought you full scale, four square, right into the heart of the fight, wasn't it?
Well, I think so, and I think, you know, for people who've been working on the organization before I came, and frankly a lot of people around Washington who tended to be, you know, kind of more lawyerly or think tanks or looking at it from a policy matter, I don't think anybody knew how angry people were and how much interest would come up by doing this. And I think what everybody found was, you know, once you let your members know and said, look, we got to do something about it, whether it was communicating with the FCC or our members of Congress after they made the decision that they did, you know, we just got thousands and thousands of responses, as everybody else did. And I think our internet list grew four or five times, a lot of it related to that issue, a lot of it related probably to people's concern about coverage over the war. But I think every one of these other issues, including like local licensing and a whole variety of things, upset people.
Yeah, you know, along those lines, I know that the group Move On, the internet activist group that's really closely connected, I think, to the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, Move On, they informed me when I spoke to Eli Pariser, who worked there, and Wes Boyd, who's one of the people who runs Move On. They both informed me that when they sent out their advisories or alerts about media ownership, the first one or two they sent out in the spring of 2003, they got a stronger response from their hundreds of thousands of members or millions of members than they did when they sent out their anti-war pieces. They said no issue they've ever done before or since has gotten the same response as the call to stop media concentration.
Which I think, you know, again, as I'm sure you've known for a long time, is that people see this as a core issue, and almost every problem that you try to solve, you know, whether it's why we're in the war or the cost of health care or environmental issues, almost everything has some connection to either how the media covers it or the people's ability to access good information. I mean, there is a component of what's going on with the media today in everything that we're trying to solve. And so it's, in a way, no surprise.
You know, one of the reasons I think that people have been despondent about the ability to make this an issue is something that probably Common Cause knows better than anyone, which is these media firms have enormous and very powerful lobbying apparatus in Washington. I think there are over 1,000 lobbyists working on telecom, media, communication issues on the Hill, corporate lobbyists working for the industry. And compared to, the number working on the other side is probably in two digits if we're lucky on
yeah,
a good
exactly.
day.
Exactly. And we know them all.
And we know them all. We're,
yeah.
we're two of them here.
We're close friends.
Yeah. You know, it's a mismatch. But there's an enormous lobbying effort. And they also are tremendous contributors to political candidates. So it seems like this is an awfully difficult issue to have any hope of getting anywhere on Capitol Hill. I mean, What is, how?
Yeah, you're right. No, you're absolutely right. And again, that's part for us of drawing the connection for people of the influence of money in politics today. I mean, this is frankly why most public policy is made, is because the strength and the money behind the lobby that wants to enforce it. And we know it very well because our offices on Connecticut Avenue are exactly across the street from the National Association of Broadcasters, big, beautiful building. And they have always considered themselves and been considered to be the most powerful force. So I think that's why it was so striking to people that when the FCC decided what it did, and as you know, without having many public meetings or hearings and mostly meeting with insiders, the fact that Congress heard so much from their constituents and frankly decided to take this on, and in virtually every vote has voted to rescind those rules. It's really the leadership in Congress that has been blocking us from getting an actual final vote on the decision. But I think it shocked everybody that you could have such a powerful lobby lose. And it was, you know, surprising to the Washington Post and the usual political pundits, but I think it again told everyone not only how strongly people feel in this country and how their influence on members of Congress had an impact, but also that many members of Congress, again, on both sides of the aisle, were starting to say, you know what, I'm tired of the hold that they have on me, and no one knows better than a member of Congress that the biggest stranglehold of all is the money you've got to raise to get your information out on TV so that you can even let your constituents know who you are and what you're doing. So
yeah, and
it's more powerful.
And as you pointed out before, Shelley, I mean, I think the frustration many members feel is they not only have to raise all this money to put on these TV ads, which I think are of dubious value in their own right, but there's much less news coverage of candidates on radio or television than there was 10, 20, 30 years ago. So you aren't even getting any sort of press coverage to speak of. It's all coming down to advertising and raising money for these ads.
Absolutely. And I think, again, I mean, I observed that in my tenure, even as a state legislator, that the newsrooms were starting to shrink, that the newspapers couldn't keep somebody in their state house bureau anymore. People just don't. I mean, the media doesn't pay as much attention to everything that goes on. And that, you know, that's frustrating when you're a public servant and you want people to hear both sides of the story.
Well, let's talk now, Shelley Pingree, about an issue that Common Cause has really sort of taken the initiative on in the past few months in the spring and summer of 2004. And that's what's going on with public broadcasting in the United States. And, you know, we're on an NPR station right here, a very successful one. At least I think it's successful. Certainly it's successful aesthetically. The commercial success is another matter. But it has a large listenership, and there's a very stable and established PBS television station affiliated with us at WILL here. What's going on with public broadcasting nationally? Why is Common Cause getting interested in this issue?
Well, I think all of us, when we express our concerns about what's going on with the commercial media, hold on to the hope that we will always have a strong public broadcasting system in our country. And when we surveyed our own members, we found that their most popular sources of news were national public radio and their local newspaper. So we know that a lot of people today turn to the public broadcasting airwaves to get their information. And because this is the year that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is reauthorized, we thought it was extremely important for people to be well-informed about the decisions that were going to be made.
How often do they reauthorize the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
It seems to be somewhat random, as I understand it. I don't think it's happened for 10 years. So it is significant. And
what is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting? A lot of our listeners probably say, well, now where are they coming into the picture?
Well, they're the umbrella under which all of the public broadcasting entities operate. Mm-hmm. And they have a separate board, and one of the biggest alarms that was raised was when the president appointed two members to the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in the recess period over Christmas, both of whom seemed to express a lack of interest in the future of public broadcasting and for a lot of us raised concerns about what has been a traditional firewall of the board staying away from an influence on programming.
Could you explain why appointing these two appointments over the Christmas recess, why that matters, that it wasn't done over the Halloween recess?
Well, I don't suppose that it was just about Christmas, but recess appointments traditionally are a way to put someone in a position during a period of time when Congress isn't in session and perhaps there's less public view or actual opportunity to take a stand in the appointment process. So recess appointments can be done by the president virtually with no oversight of Congress. For those people who watch this issue, it gave a majority to the board of people who perhaps were less interested in maintaining this firewall or the future of kind of balanced programming for the CPB. And I think that that raised a high level of concern. I know a lot of organizations, and I think probably you're one of the people who believe this, is that we should have an appointment process for the CPB that is somewhat, you know, if possible, removed from politics. That's not a place where you maybe give an appointment to someone who's given you campaign contributions or shown themselves to be a supporter, but where we really put people who care about the media and programming and arts and literacy and many of the things that we count on the CPB to do.
You know, the two Bush appointments we're talking about that were Gayheart Gaines and Cheryl Halpern, both of their families have given more than $800,000, according to the Common Cause press release, to the Republican Party and Republican candidates just in the last 9 years.
So that's pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean, I'd bend over and pick it up if I walked by it on the street. But, I mean, what other qualifications do Gayheart Gaines and Cheryl Halpern have to be on the board overseeing public broadcasting, to your knowledge?
Well, nothing that I know of. And again, you know, we think that in a perfect world, this should be restructured in such a way that the appointees are people who actually have either a tradition in the world of broadcasting, arts, literacy, you know, many of the things that we think of as really valuable. Now, the second concern that was explained extremely well by Ken Aletta in a story in The New Yorker was about the future of programming on PBS, on the television station. Now, we have a lot of members, and I know there are many people around the country who are huge fans of Bill Moyers. And he sadly for all of us, will be retiring in the fall. And one of the proposals is to cut back now, which will be a wonderful show, even when he's not there, I'm sure, to a half an hour, and to add two new pieces of programming, in a sense, in what some people think is to give more balance to the other side. On public broadcasting. One of them will be a one-hour show with Tucker Carlson as the host, and the other with Paul Gigot of the Wall Street Journal. Now, the way it was reported in the story is that they will be fully funded by public funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, constituting two full hours of paid programming, and a half-an-hour show by Bill Moyers will be required to do its own fundraising to continue. I think another concern was that, again, from the story, it was said that there will be a journalistic standard required of the Bill Moyers show, while the other two will be allowed to be somewhat more of an opinion piece. So, while these aren't necessarily, you know, dramatic, you know, changes in some people's minds, they reflect a different way of viewing how public broadcasting might be conducting its business in the future, and I think have raised alarm for a lot of people. I know that since we started informing our members and other organizations did as well, there have been a tremendous number of concerns expressed about that, both to the board of CPB and to members of Congress who will be making some of the decisions to come in the future.
So what sort of demands are you making or Common Cause making with regard to the situation? Are there specific demands you're making that you want Congress to do or the CPB to do?
Well, I think, again, part of what we're really interested in doing is asking people to stand back and think about the long-term future of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I think it's a good time to be thinking about funding sources that are permanent and not dependent on the political whims or perhaps even just the corporate contributions that are accessible to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I think the importance of thinking about who is on the board and maintaining the firewall are all concerns that we think about as we think about how important it is to have a source of news and information and programming in the country that is relatively commercial-free, that is allowed to do in-depth reporting and tackle controversial issues in the way that we get the sense that the corporate media is willing to do less and less and less. I mean, for us, this was contrasted by a completely different decision at Sinclair Broadcasting when Ted Koppel wanted to just list the names of the people who had died, and they decided to remove, you know, they were unwilling to, you know, play that on some of their local stations. So I think, you know, for us, it's seeing the encroachment of strong political beliefs in the commercial media and just hoping that we can continue to have a public source of information that will continue to be balanced but also take a hard look at the problems that are facing us.
Well, I think it's safe to say that the listeners to this program, Media Matters, and people who listen to WILL AM 580 are very interested in having strong nonprofit, non-commercial radio broadcasting in the United States. And they should go to www.commoncause.org if they want to participate in this campaign. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, we're talking a lot about the CPB, but as you know, the radio waves have every bit as many problems with Clear Channel and a whole variety of other concerns on that side. So we feel like we're, you know, in a war that has so many battle fronts, it's hard to know on any day where to turn.
You know, you were talking earlier about how when media sort of exploded as an issue last year, it caught everyone in Washington by surprise, even the people who have been working on this issue for a long time. Sometimes you get the sense that inside the Beltway, it's such a different world that really doesn't have a grasp on what life is like in Lewiston, Maine, or in Decatur, Illinois. What is, I mean, I don't think people, most people know, and there's no reason they should know, what it takes to change something in Congress, to get a law passed, as simple as that sounds. You know, if we wanted to, for example, increase the budget for public broadcasting and pass a law saying no more corporate underwriting. It's all got to, you know, no more advertising on public television, for example. How would we do that? Well, I mean, you know, what would the steps be to make that actually become an actual policy in place?
Well, I think your first point is a really important one, that people have to constantly remind themselves that there is an inside the Beltway way of thinking that often transcends really how the American public feels. And the most important thing is to break down that barrier when there's an issue that you want to change, because sometimes there's just not enough oxygen in Washington for people to think straight. And one of the great things that happened, I think, in this media debate is that people from Illinois and Texas and Virginia and just all over the country weighed in and said, wait a minute, don't we own the airwaves? Isn't there something we ought to be doing about this? And they called and emailed and contacted their member of Congress. They went to in-district meetings. They, you know, they went to a website. I mean, they got the information that they needed, and they let people know how they felt. And, in fact, that is the greatest remedy for the problem that is suffered in Washington, is when people just sort of look around their community. And I know, you know, the town I come from in Maine lost half of its radio stations to Clear Channel Radio, and nobody knew there was something they could do about it until they started seeing this fight and this debate. And you can ask anybody in my community, and they will say, hey, radio's just not the same anymore. We don't have local weather. We don't have our basketball teams on there anymore. It's just every channel's exactly the same. So people know what's going on, and the way to break down the barrier is really to be an active participant. And all too often, I think people don't understand how strong their voice is. You know, there is nothing a member of Congress fears more than having to face a local constituent, either at an in-district meeting or in the grocery store or wherever you might happen to encounter each other, and hear that you're dissatisfied with what's going on. And I think that's where we've gotten the strength in this movement. I think it's an incredibly important time where there are so many battles going on that people recognize this is an opportunity to really change things back to the way they either once were or in a way we imagine they could be in the future.
We're talking to Shelley Pingree, the Chief Executive Officer and President of Common Cause, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got about 8 or 9 minutes left. And Shelley, a couple issues I want to turn to before the show's over. First of all, in relating to what you were just talking about, I know that you've got on the Common Cause website, make media an issue in 04, let your legislators know where you stand, that you think media is important. What is this all about, and what are the prospects of making media a political issue in 04?
Well, I think all of us are trying to get, first, the presidential candidates to talk about it. We're trying to turn up the heat under members of Congress who may not have decided exactly how they feel or haven't been our supporters. This is the time of year that, whether it's someone running for president or someone running for a congressional seat in your state, they're walking around looking for your support and your vote. And these are the times to ask the tough questions about their vote, about where they stand, and to get them to pledge and promise to support the things that we think are really critical. And you can find on our website and many other websites talking about these very media issues, whether it's public broadcasting or repealing the consolidation of corporate ownership rules. There's just a whole variety of issues that are out there or will be coming up like low power FM and access to more local radio stations. So this is a very good time for people to be active, and it depends on what state you're in and what member of Congress you're talking about, but they should not go unchallenged.
Now, as for the presidential race, I'm just wondering, when you sit down with President Bush and members of his staff and Karl Rove to talk about these issues, how do they respond to issues?
Oh, and I just want you to know they have had us into the White House so many times to discuss this issue. It's all open arms. Frankly, you know, what we hear is that the reason things are held up in Congress is basically because the White House does not want to undo the decision made by the FCC. So we haven't been really successful at having a lot of conversations with them, and I think all of us have been trying hard to get this on Senator Kerry's radar screen as well, but I think people have concerns with both candidates. And
What is Kerry, to the extent we know, what is John Kerry's voting record like on these issues in his several terms in the U.S. Senate?
Well, I have to tell you the truth. We have yet to have a sort of a media conversation with him, although he's kind of opening up some opportunities to talk about it. I think there was a lot of concern from people who've been here far longer than me that there had been times in the past when he was a supporter of allowing more consolidation of ownership in the media, which if you go to the core of this issue here, for all the things we're trying to fix and all we're trying to look at into the future, so much of it has to do with how much you allow one corporation to own of the media, of the radio, of TV, of newspapers, and how a little diversity there is increasingly in ownership. So I think people have great concerns about where Kerry is, and I think all of us are trying our hardest to get it on the map, get him to think more about it, and hope that if it turns out he becomes the next president of the United States, we can ask him to, you know, tackle this issue right away.
Now, in your year or two in Washington, since you've been running Common Cause and working those issues, are there any politicians on Capitol Hill or regulators that you've had experiences with who've really impressed you with their concern about media issues, the importance of media issues, and their desire to really fix the problem? God, I hope you aren't going to say no. That'd be depressing.
I mean, I think different members of Congress have shown an interest in different issues, and I will honestly tell you I'm not the person who spends the most time on the Hill for Common Cause, but I think all of us would agree that Commissioner Copps and Commissioner Adelstein have done just a phenomenal job.
And these are the two Democrats on the five-member FCC.
Right, and in a time when, you know, when Commissioner Powell has showed so little interest in the issues, in spite of the fact that the public has flooded them with, you know, complaints and comments, these two commissioners have really put this issue on the map in a way that no one ever thought it could be done. The fact that they went around the country, held public meetings prior to the June 2nd vote, have continued to really participate in every possible meeting and forum on this issue, and have continued to push for most of the things that we care about, I think has shown phenomenal courage on their part, because it's not easy when you're serving with colleagues who disagree with what you do and when you have a chair who would like to shut down all dialogue and debate. And they've really become heroes in an issue that could be kind of obscure, somewhat nerdy, you know, where you have to talk about things like duopolies and cross-ownerships and, you know, all kinds of things that don't normally, you know, hit all of our radar screen. They've made it somewhat popular, and you know, we can even see them occasionally up on stage playing the harmonica with rock musicians. And, you know, they're just great. And I think I can't say enough about how much of a difference they've made in this issue.
In the congressional side, are there any members that you've heard about or you've worked with personally, you've dealt with, that seem to really be people taking initiative here? I'm asking this because oftentimes our listeners are interested in knowing which candidates they should be, you know, following and supporting and be in touch with if they want to work on something.
Well, you probably have a list, and I can tell you if I agree or not.
Okay, I won't hold you accountable here then. I'll let you off the hook. Shelley Pinker.
Well, I will tell you one thing though. What's interesting about this is we've found people on both sides of the aisle. You know, you can go from Bernie Sanders one day to Trent Lott the other day, and you'll find a supporter where you didn't expect one, which is what I think is so fascinating about this debate. And most of them, I would say, either have had an experience that's really led them to believe that, yes, this is a problem, or frankly, they've heard so much from their constituents, they can't keep ignoring the problem anymore.
Shelley, what sort of media issues do you anticipate coming up on the horizon that maybe we haven't been talking about yet, but that you think in the next year or two or three are going to really be the sort of issues that citizens need to be thinking about and preparing for, and groups like Common Cause will probably have to be working on if we want to really improve our media system?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, I'd be interested to hear what you think about this, but I really think, you know, so often when you're in this debate, people will say to you, oh, why are you worrying about broadcast TV? You know, we've got so many choices these days. We've got the Internet. We've got everything in front of us. And I really think that the Internet and, you know, the change in the way our lives are going to work, the change in the way that we're going to access information, the tie between broadcast news, cable news, I mean, you know, broadcast and cable, and our computers and the delivery channels will be one of the most important challenges that we face is how will we continue to have the same level of open access to the Internet, to the diversity of information, and in fact, how do we increase it? Because already commercial sources are owning more and more of what we see there.
So you think there's a real chance that what people like about the Internet now may be taken away, or there's no reason to think it's just going to automatically stay there or improve?
Yeah, I mean, I do think so. There was a senator who said in response to one of these, you know, arguments that, look, we have so many different choices today, and he said, yeah, many voices, one ventriloquist. And before you know it, you know, you're going to find that some of the very same people own the programming, the networks, the distribution channels, and, you know, I know in my community a lot of people get access to television through DirecTV, which is now owned by Rupert Murdoch, and pretty soon they're going to get their Internet through a satellite. And before you know it, will we have the same access to the same diversity of information that we now do? Or will we have to pay for sources that seem different, just as we do on TV today? I mean, people never used to think that we would have to pay for television, but a lot of the, you know, independent and interesting, you know, television that's being done today comes through channels like HBO that not everybody has access to. So
we only have a few seconds left, Shelley. The last question I'd like to ask you is, what media do you use to stay informed? And if you can just a few seconds sketch out, look, your daily media consumption diet.
Well, I like to get a little diversity in my diet. So I think I wake up to NPR. I usually read the Washington Post because I'm in Washington, D.C. I look at the New York Times. I read my local newspapers from Maine because they give me kind of a different perspective on what is going on.
And they're owned by Frank Blethyn.
And they are owned by Frank Blethyn, one of the few heroes in the newspaper business left today. I read a few blogs. I like to listen to country western stations so I can get something local in AM once in a while and just hear what they're, you know, talking about from a slightly different perspective. And then I'm a big fan of just plain old conversation. You know, I like to hear what people have to say, and I'm particularly fond of traveling around the country and seeing what people say in the local coffee shop and, you know, gas station, because I think sort of gossip and handed down information is sometimes where you really get a sense of what the world is thinking.
Well, on that note, Shelley Pingree, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters. Shelley Pingree is the president of Common Cause. You can learn about that august organization at www.commoncause.org. My name is Bob McChesney. I'll be back one week from today. And again, thank you, Shelley.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. It's a baffling phenomenon. Why have some young British Muslims become seduced by the call to arms of radical Islamist preachers?
People like Omar Bakri know that you can tap into the fundamental frustrations of a young man and get him to rise up and express his frustration elsewhere.
An investigation into why Britain has become a recruitment center for suicide bombers and the global jihad. Join me for British Jihad Inside Out.
Monday morning at 11 here on WILL Urbana. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high in the upper 80s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 60s and southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high in the middle 80s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.